From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, PETA Thornycroft tells us about life as one of the few independent reporters left in Zimbabwe, where the economy is collapsing and the rate of inflation exceeds 5,000%. Thornycroft renounced her British citizenship so she could remain in the country and keep reporting. Also, back pain and how to treat it. We talk with Dr. James Weinstein. The Dartmouth Medical School professor is an expert on the back. He'll tell us why surgery is often not the best solution. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new soundtrack album for the soon-to-be-released Bob Dylan biopic. The film doesn't open for a few weeks, but the music is already out there. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. For the past several years, the world has watched the civic and economic disintegration of the African nation of Zimbabwe under the rule of dictator Robert Mugabe. Our guest, Peta Thornycroft, is one of the few independent journalists who's watched the events from inside Zimbabwe. Thornycroft was born and raised in the country when it was the white-ruled nation of Rhodesia. She continued to report on the country's crisis after foreign journalists were expelled, renouncing her British citizenship in 2001 to remain in Zimbabwe. Thornycroft has just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. Robert Mugabe was the leader of one of two black rebel groups that took power from a white supremacist government in 1980. Mugabe soon eliminated his internal opposition and established himself as Zimbabwe's ruler, though the country still goes through the formality of elections. Zimbabwe's current crisis has its root in a sweeping confiscation of white-owned farms that began in 2000. Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party initiated the campaign in part to punish an opposition movement led by Morgan Tsvangirai. As the country's agricultural economy collapsed, inflation soared. I spoke to Peta Thornycroft last week and asked her why food, fuel, and other necessities have become so scarce in Zimbabwe lately.
In June, the outgoing U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe, Christopher Dell, made a statement that Zimbabwe's rampant inflation would totally collapse the economy by year end. The military, who really run President Robert Mugabe and run policy, got a real panic. They interpreted this as a Western plot to effect regime change. That's what they say. And so they immediately set up a price task force and they froze prices as of June the 18th. With about 8,000% inflation, that's at the official rate, it meant that within a few days, prices for retail goods were 50% below the cost of production. The supermarkets were faced with no local goods. There were still some imported goods in some of the upmarket supermarkets, but really 99.999% of people can't afford to buy those goods. In the regular supermarkets throughout the country, the following items were missing: cooking oil, margarine, butter, sugar, flour, meat, excepting a little bit of pork, bread, and all dairy products. So all the basic essentials for nutrition were missing. There were some fruit and vegetables, and it took about 3 weeks before the black market clicked in. Zimbabwe has an extremely efficient black market, both for money and for goods that are in short supply. And so the black market started to get over, but I would say that 80% of the population were excluded from buying on the black market because they simply couldn't afford it.
So it does sound like an economic collapse. Let me ask, how do you get food and household goods that you need when you're there?
Because I earn foreign currency. I take essentials with me to Zimbabwe. I hardly ever travel with things like clothes. I've always got bottles of cooking oil and melting margarine in my suitcase and spilling yogurts in my suitcase and powdered milk and tinned meats and biscuits and things like that. I take things up with me. And then, because I have access to foreign currency, I hang around and listen as to where there might be some meat available, where there might be some essentials, and you pare down your diet. You just cut all essentials out.
Well, let's talk about how we got here. I mean, what President Mugabe will say is that, you know, a few years back he took the bold step of redistributing the country's resources from wealthy whites to disenfranchised blacks, in effect nationalizing industries and taking over farms. Why did this lead to the collapse of Zimbabwe's economy?
Commercial agriculture had always produced 40% of foreign currency, and that was produced by agricultural exports, grown 95% by white commercial farmers because they had the training and the resources to do it, and they were really good at what they did. And a new political party arose in September 1999, and fought a referendum in February 2000 in which the farm workers, mobilized to an extent by their employers, who represented the largest voting bloc in Zimbabwe, delivered Mugabe his first political defeat in February 2000 and rejected this new constitution. And Mugabe then turned on the farmers. They had been simmering. There were requests by people for more land. The land resettlement program since independence had not been a great success. So there was this discontent. There were no jobs in the manufacturing sector, few jobs in the business sector. Mugabe needed something to give people, to perhaps as all politicians do, and he chose to do it in two ways: to stop the opposition's support, massive support from the farm workers and the white farmers who had the resources to assist the opposition party, and to distribute that land, first of all, to landless people, but largely the main, best, richest, well-endowed first world farms were given to members of his cabinet, the military, the judges, senior civil servants, the police, anyone he needed
his
in
cronies,
order
in effect,
to maintain
yeah.
the status quo.
Once the farms are confiscated, I mean, it doesn't necessarily follow that changing ownership would lead to a collapse of production. Why did the change of ownership of these farms lead to such a widespread economic decline?
I think, first of all, that Mugabe never intended it to go as far as it did, actually. It developed a life of its own. Secondly, the people who took the farms, the white farmers, had made it look so easy. You drove past their farms, everything was neat and clipped, and the maize was all at the right same height. It looked so easy. I think they had no idea of the difference between growing some corn around a small patch of land in your communal area and growing, you know, vast acreages of land in a first world context where you have to raise money from the banks and do it in a first world way. And they just did not have that experience. They had not been trained for it. And they didn't realize that it was a full-time job. And this is not to say they're not some excellent farmers,
right?
Who did take farmland that Mugabe gave them and are producing well, but they're in a tiny minority. We suspect that of all the 20 million acres taken for redistribution, less than 10% of it has been productively used.
We're speaking with journalist Pita Thornycroft. She is a citizen of Zimbabwe and reports on that country for the London Daily Telegraph, the Voice of America, and other publications. Let's talk a bit about the political situation. I mean, Mugabe, of course, was a leader of a guerrilla movement, ZANU, one of two, which struggled against the white minority government and succeeded, and as he has been in power since 1980, has increasingly imposed restrictions on opposition. What is the level of political expression that is allowed in Zimbabwe today? Can one hold a political meeting? Can one publicly criticize the president?
You can hold a political meeting if you apply to the police for permission, and if the police give that permission, and then even if they do, they may break it up. That is, there's two weekly independent newspapers which have a tiny circulation in the cities only. They never get out there. The four radio stations are controlled by the government. The only daily newspapers are controlled by the government, and even they don't get distributed in the rural areas because people are too poor to buy them. So there's virtually no political activity excepting that run and controlled by Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF.
And those who stage public protests are greeted often with arrests or, what, beatings, torture, right?
90% of those people who stage demonstrations, which get smaller and smaller every year, are arrested, and a majority of them are beaten by police when they're arrested, sometimes to within an inch of their lives, and sometimes one of them's just died from the march beatings. Yes, you cannot hold demonstrations. People do. They dart into the street for 35 seconds, get whacked over the head, and they dart back a month later. And the women of Zimbabwe Rise regularly hold meetings, and when the police come for them, they sit down, they get taken off to police stations, they do or they don't get beaten up. There's no civil protest allowed, endured, or even really taking place.
You've written several pieces about this group that you mentioned, the Women of Zimbabwe Arise. Who are they, and just tell us a little bit about their activities.
They're a group of civil society activists who want democracy. They're led by mostly women from the second city, Bulawayo. That's where it started. And they are pacifists. They will not ever resort to violence or hit back if, or even physically protest if they're being beaten. They just sit there and allow them, rather in the Gandhi tradition, they just sit there and allow themselves to be beaten and arrested.
Now there is a parliament in Zimbabwe, right? And there are actually opposition members of the parliament, right? Just talk a little bit about what the opposition is like. I mean, I gather that there's a movement which is divided. What are the prospects for an effective opposition to Mugabe?
They came so close in 2000 to winning a parliamentary majority. They will tell you that they didn't win those four seats. They were short of a parliamentary majority because of violence and vote rigging. I think there was less vote rigging, certainly violence, in 2000. When it came to the presidential election in 2002, the elections, to an extent, were just a joke. In 2005, at the general election for parliamentary seats, the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, had tragically split into two factions. And they'd lost their heart, their organization, their whatever it was, and they'd lost a third of their seats in those elections. And they rarely count for very little in the public life of Zimbabwe or any life in Zimbabwe. However, they made enough of an impact that they are now engaged in negotiations with the ruling ZANU-PF in secret talks facilitated by South African President Thabo Mbeki, who wants an end, finally, he wants an end to the crisis in Zimbabwe, and he wants the next elections due in March 2008 to be undisputed. That's what his words were, undisputed elections.
And as you look at the opposition figures, do you see a leader or a movement that you could see at some point bringing a successful transition to democracy and a hope for honest and responsible government?
There are great heroes in both factions of the divided Movement for Democratic Change, and there are great heroes amongst civil society activists in the civil rights movement. So far, they're plagued with a number of things, not least being infiltration by ZANU-PF, who've played a very clever role in assisting to divide the party. I think this generation of opposition activists may pass on, you know, and perhaps become elder statesmen, because they seem exhausted at the moment, because it's been 7 long years. The efforts to get the two sides together have failed. I'm quite sure they failed because ZANU-PF managed to rouse opposition to the deal that had been put together for an
ZANU-PF
election
being,
pact.
Just for the audience, ZANU-PF, that's the Mugabe's party, right? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. ZANU-PF is Mugabe's party. So all these efforts, there's just an exhaustion, really, and both parties, and one party has got access to resources. God knows where it gets its resources, but it's got access to resources. The other opposition faction hasn't got anything at all. So I don't even know how they'll get enough money to go to nomination court and register candidates for the next election.
We're speaking with journalist Pita Thornycroft. She reports from Zimbabwe for several Western publications and African publications. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pita Thornycroft. She's a freelance journalist living in Zimbabwe and one of the few independent journalists reporting from that country. She's just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. Well, I wanted to talk a bit about your life. I mean, you grew up in this country when it was Rhodesia. Can you just say a little bit about, you know, your family, what it did for a living, kind of how your place in Rhodesian society when you were young?
I grew up on the border of Zimbabwe and Mozambique in a very wild part of the country. My family, my mother, and the rest of my family We lived in the bush. They commuted across terrible roads to town and ran a small transport business. Uh-huh. And we had a very rural childhood, very happy, contented, quite poor rural childhood where we lacked for nothing, really, apart from more sophisticated material goods. But we had a wonderful childhood. And we grew up and, this eldest son went into his father's business and I went away. I was the one who went away, but the rest of the family more or less went into the family business. And then, of course, there was the war.
You married and moved to South Africa, is that right?
I did.
Did you always regard Zimbabwe or Rhodesia as your home?
Yes, I did.
Tell me a little bit about what you love about this country. I mean, what is it you miss when you're away?
It's incredibly beautiful. I mean, you've got images probably in America of Kenya and the Great Plains of Kenya. Everything in Zimbabwe is better. It's so beautiful. Its natural resources have been well cared for. The people are so incredibly gentle, which is to their disadvantage at the moment. It's an incredibly nice place. It was very advanced in Africa over alternative energy. It had the best educated population in Africa, and that's thanks to Mugabe. And good foundations, in fact, laid down by the British so that, unlike South Africa, where there was unequal education, any blacks who managed to get education had the same education as whites. So with independence, that education expanded massively. The healthcare expanded massively. It seemed that it was the jewel of Africa fulfilling its destiny. And then, unfortunately, in just 2 years after independence, Mugabe started his tribal and ethnic purge in the south of the country against the then opposition. But it is a very moral society. Those morals are breaking down along with the financial collapse. But it's a very safe society. I am still, to this day, safer in a high-density area in Harare than I would be in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. I don't ever feel under threat from the ordinary people in Zimbabwe. I certainly don't think I'll have my throat slit as I might in Johannesburg or be shot. So there's this, the people have always been engaged, especially in comparison with South Africa. When you cross the border from South Africa, there's this a nation of extraordinary charm and of beauty.
You were arrested in 2002, is that right? Mm. Tell us what happened.
Yes, I was.
What happened?
It was after the presidential election. I got a call that they were beating opposition supporters up in this rural area, in this mountains around this village, and destroying their possessions and punishing them, suspecting they'd voted for the opposition. And I went down to see what it was, and I was in the process of actually trying to get a comment from an introduction to a ZANU-PF official for fairness and balance. I was sitting in a cafe waiting, and they just surrounded me and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm a journalist." And I identified myself. They weren't satisfied. They thought I was from the British Navy and that the British Navy was going to be invading Zimbabwe from Mozambique. I didn't actually know that at the time, but they definitely didn't believe I was a journalist. They definitely thought I was there for a Western government to effect regime change.
And how long were you held?
Only 5 days.
And were you mistreated?
No. I mean, it's mistreatment to be in those filthy, decrepit, inhumane cells, which have been declared inhumane even by these courts. They are inhumane conditions, but I was not mistreated. I wasn't abused in any way. I heard people being abused in other cells, men being abused, and there was one policeman there who they've since got rid of who looked after me. I mean, he was extraordinary. I mean, he said to me at the beginning, "Don't say anything, I'm going to see you right." Because not all of the policemen, not all of the soldiers have forgotten their commitment to democracy and the oaths they took of office to treat people free and fair. And he looked after me, but he asked me to make a statement when I came out to say that I had been abused, and I said, "I cannot lie." So I tried to just say, I talked about the conditions in the cells, which were absolutely atrocious. I talked about that, and I was a great deal luckier than blacks being arrested, because I was white. I worked for a big newspaper. There was an enormous amount of publicity about it. I could afford a lawyer. The company bought me a lawyer. I knew VOA and people in Washington were looking out for me, but so many people were arrested and they got nothing. I mean, they were just lost.
And now you're operating in a country where, you know, political expression is virtually outlawed, where demonstrators are beaten, where foreign journalists are effectively banned. How do you do your work? Can you interview someone openly? How do you file your pieces without censorship?
I just do it because we won those who've managed through good luck, mostly, and some planning. Those of us who've survived, and they're very few, there's a handful, who've survived to continue telling the tale, in a way we won some space. They're used to us. They see us around. But you get frights, and then you leave. You suddenly go away for a couple of few months and hang out in South Africa and then go back.
Well, Peta Thornycroft, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Peta Thornycroft lives in and reports from Zimbabwe. She's just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Women's Media Foundation. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the National Cooperative Business Association, informing consumers about America's cooperatives and their 130 million members. Details at go.coop. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Netflix and Fox Home Entertainment, presenting 28 Weeks Later, about the aftermath of a deadly virus in London. At Netflix.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, I'm not there yet, but the soundtrack is. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews an album of Bob Dylan covers associated with the upcoming biopic. Also, alternatives to surgery for back pain. We talk with Dr. James Weinstein, one of the country's leading experts on the back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. So maybe you forget to bend your knees when you lift, or you twist your body too fast shoveling snow and feel a little pop at the bottom of your back. You've just joined the not-so-exclusive club of back pain sufferers. Symptoms can vary from a persistent twinge to excruciating pain. And treatments are as varied as the symptoms. Should you have surgery? Should you consider more conservative treatments like physical therapy, or alternatives like chiropractic care? We thought we'd speak to one of the country's leading back doctors about the options. Dr. James Weinstein is chairman of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Dartmouth Medical School and editor of the medical journal Spine. He also heads the ongoing research project Spine Patient Outcome Research Trial, or SPORT, which compares the effectiveness of surgical to non-surgical treatments for the three most commonly diagnosed back problems. Terry spoke to Weinstein earlier this month. She asked him if his results show whether surgery is effective for people suffering from disc herniation.
We had 1,200 patients enrolled, which is the largest study by far. And in that case, what was really impressive, Terry, was the improvement of the patients who didn't have any surgery. The surgical patients got better a little faster, but when you look at the results, the non-operative patients, their improvement was really much more than I had anticipated and very significant. I think what that allows for in that particular diagnosis, again, is that not that surgery or non-surgical treatment's the best choice one way or the other, but it allows the patient to understand there is an option here.
Okay, so that's disc herniation. What about stenosis? How effective was surgery there?
Yes, in the study that we published in the New England Journal this past spring, summer, that was patients who had spinal stenosis with a slippage of the vertebrae. And in that case, the data showed that patients with surgery did better. It was heartwarming to me to know that in this spinal stenosis condition that we actually were making the patients better and there was a benefit to treatment.
Let's talk a little bit about non-surgical treatments that you've found to be effective. Let's start with the most basic one, physical therapy. I know you advocate keeping moving after a back injury. How effective do you think physical therapy is in healing back problems and preventing recurrences?
The fact of the matter is most spinal conditions, 85 to 90% get better with essentially no treatment. And if you take physical therapy as being resuming your normal activities, then I would advocate for that. A specific exercise program, I think, can be important if you need that kind of help. But the most important thing is to try to get back to your normal activities as soon as you can. And I've given this story before about my wife who had a serious disc problem and had severe pain. And, you know, treating your family members is always dangerous, and I hope she won't get mad at me for talking about this. But the fact of the matter is, I said, honey, you need to, you know, get going. Do what you normally do. Go running. Go off to your job. And I think she was about ready to throw me out of the house because she said, I know you're supposed to be an expert, but I'm telling you, I can't do any of that, and you're crazy. And I understand that because I see patients tell me that every day sometimes. But I said, honey, please do that, and I think you'll feel better. So I helped her strap on a little bit of a corset, and she went running, and she came back, and she said, you know, I am a little better. But it's really hard to get somebody to do that when they're in so much discomfort. And I've had the problem myself. I went to a post office one day, and I bent over to get the mail from my post office box, and I couldn't stand up. And I said, well, it serves me right. I'm always telling people to get going, and now I have to do it myself. And, you know, I crawled to my car holding on to the parking meters to get back to my car, laughing at myself a little bit that I can't believe this happened. But I'm a runner, too, and I said I've got to just do it. And I've found over the years that when I've had people and patients get back to what they do despite the discomfort, which can be extraordinary pain and discomfort, that they do get better faster.
I'm with your wife. I think it sounds absolutely insane if you're in serious back pain to go out running. not only that. I thought that a lot of spinal doctors were kind of down on running because of all the pressure it puts on the spine.
Yeah, I'm one of those. I don't know if you call them crazy runners, and I agree with you that it's hurtful, but hurt doesn't mean harm.
But sometimes it means harm, right?
Well, it means hurt. It means hurt, but the fact that you're talking about, you know, not running because you might affect your joints or your disc, there's really very little evidence for that. And in fact, it's not that compression force that always causes the problem. It's more of the shear or gliding forces that actually can affect the cartilage and joints. But really, staying physically active and in good shape, you know, it's not just good for your back. It's good for your heart. It's good for your muscles. It's good for your bones. So you don't get osteoporosis, et cetera. So yes, it does hurt. And I've I've been there, and I think I appreciate it. And, you know, people and listeners will say, well, you don't have it as bad as I do, and that's probably true in many cases. But I do know that hurt doesn't always mean harm. You're not going to become paralyzed with this spine problem, which patients fear that, you know, sometimes they're told if you don't take care of this, you could be in a wheelchair or you. That's scaring patients unnecessarily. In our studies, we didn't have any patient become paralyzed. No patient lost function, surgical or non-surgical. And so those are rare events. When they occur, they're a disaster and they're a tragedy, and we pray that they never happen. But they're very uncommon.
But, you know, in that whole hurt isn't always harm that you were saying, if you have, say, a disc problem where there's a herniation and something from the disc is pressing on a nerve, if you do certain exercises or do certain activities, can't that put more pressure on the nerve and inflame the nerve further, making it more difficult for the nerve to heal?
Absolutely, and I think that's why you want to work with your physician to make sure that you're not at risk for that to occur. But again, Terry, that's a rare event. I know it seems counterintuitive, and I know what I'm saying. You know, people would criticize, and I'm open to that criticism. But we didn't find patients who were in the non-operative group with pressure on the nerve actually getting worse. The human body is a dynamic structure, and it adapts to changes every day in ways that we, you know, have yet to totally understand. And this is something that needs more work, needs a better understanding. But I think working with your physician, they can help guide you through the non-surgical treatment and tell you if you're at risk or not at risk. But I would say from our study that risk was not what it's anticipated to be by most.
Now, what do you think of chiropractic and other approaches to spinal manipulation?
Well, I think chiropractic is something that really is a unique specialty. Touching a patient and laying hands on a patient is very important, and probably in medicine today, because of the reimbursement strategies that we study through the Institute and other things, we've sort of changed the strategy of allowing the physician to be the kind of healer that Norman Rockwell shows in his paintings. But I think we are so rushed that traditional medicine doesn't do that. I think chiropractic takes the time. They use manipulative techniques, some of which seem to help people, again, with apparently low risk. But I would say in these particular diagnoses that we studied in sport, there's very little information to support chiropractic treatment for the disc herniation or the spinal stenosis. So for those three diagnoses, I would say that chiropractic is probably not as helpful as it could be. On the other hand, it's a non-operative treatment, and if it's low risk and it helps somebody avoid an operation, then I think the patient should be informed about that risk and benefit and make a decision about trying that treatment.
Do you have an opinion on Pilates?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I think core body strength is really important. I think to do Pilates well is incredibly difficult. I think that you need to work with somebody who's really an expert so you don't hurt yourself. I see many patients in my clinic who have tried different treatments by maybe instructors that weren't really capable of actually working with people of all different ages and different conditions, meaning their physical condition, and people get injured. So I think you need to work with people that are, if there's certification in that, I'm not sure, but people who can help you and guide you through the Pilates or any exercise program in an effective way without hurting yourself. Again, hurt doesn't always mean harm, but if you're trying to exercise, you'd rather be exercising and not hurting. I think core body strength for the spine, which Pilates focuses on, is really important.
What about acupuncture for back problems?
I think acupuncture is another one of those really interesting domains where treatments that you know, certainly has a history much longer than the United States and the Chinese culture. And working on these various meridians, to me, it makes sense that you could potentially block the impulses going to the spinal cord where people actually perceive the initial part of pain going on up to the brain to actually understand they have pain. And if you can overcome those impulses through acupuncture, which is the theory, that you actually can negate the pain perception by providing information in the spinal cord that actually overwhelms that, then there is some science to that. And probably modern medicine needs to do more work to understand that at a very basic level. And for whatever reasons, we haven't done that.
Dr. James Weinstein is chairman of the Department of Orthopedics at the Dartmouth Medical School and editor of the medical journal Spine. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Dr. James Weinstein. He's chairman of the Department of Orthopedics at Dartmouth Medical School.
I want to get back to the back pain that you've had. Has it recurred over the years?
Yes.
What's your diagnosis?
My diagnosis? I have not had an X-ray or an MRI, so...
Well, why not? You doctors, you're so strange.
Yes, we are.
Why not?
I guess I could say I was afraid to see what I would find. But on the other hand, what I do know from my research and my work over the last 20 to 30 years is that diagnostic imaging studies don't always correlate, and in fact, they rarely correlate with the actual symptoms somebody has. So you could... One of the issues, as you know, in this country, is we're overusing diagnostic testing, and so I'm consciously aware of that. If we look for something, we're likely to find it, which then leads you to a pathway of different treatments, different diagnostic tests, that may in fact have no bearing on your outcome. My back pain, to me, is sort of what I would call the idiopathic. We don't really know what's causing it, but I'm guessing as I get a little older, my discs are losing a little bit of water. They're narrowing a little bit. I probably have a little bit of arthritis in my joints and my back like I do in my knees. And that periodically causes pretty significant pain. And there are days I'm not sure I can actually go through my clinical practice. And I don't say anything to my patients, but I want to tell them, you know, I hurt too, and I want to commiserate with you a little bit about your symptoms and my symptoms, and maybe you can help me. But the fact is I sit on my chair gingerly when I talk to them, and I try to get up without wincing. But I know in my mind that within, you know, 3, 7, 10 days, it's going to get better, and I should just keep doing my running and keep going. And most of the episodes I've had, Terry, over the years have gotten better.
You know, one of the expressions you often use is hurt doesn't always mean harm, and you're referring there to like exercise and movement. Just because it hurts doesn't mean you're harming yourself. But how do you tell the difference between good pain and bad pain?
The bad hurt is when things deteriorate. That's sort of my message. So in the back area, if you are hurting a lot and your symptoms are getting worse, or your leg pain is getting more severe, or you have a change in sensation, that's a time when then the hurt is causing some harm potentially. You need to sort of step back, reevaluate with your physician, and take the next steps. But I think I like to watch sports on the weekend when I have time. And sitting on the couch, you know, you can get a backache just from sitting. Sitting causes incredible pressure on the disc, more than standing. It's a bad position for the spine to sit. You need to get up from the couch and watching the game and walk around and maybe take a walk around the block at halftime or so that you're not just sitting, which is really a bad position for the disc. And so bad hurt occurs when you've become immobile or you have a condition that you're actually making worse by something that you're doing. And your body will try to get you away from that, either getting a muscle reaction or trying to get you to move into a different position.
One of the many hats that you wear is that you're the head of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practices. When it comes to spinal problems, what do you think the healthcare system doesn't get or doesn't adequately respond to?
Well, I think it's not unique to spine, but spine is one of the conditions where there's tremendous variation. So if you live on the East Coast of the United States, where we live in New Hampshire, versus where you live in Philadelphia or people in California, there's very different rates at which people have surgical procedures. Casper, Wyoming, for whatever reason, has the highest rates of back surgery in the United States. So you might be 8 times more likely to have a back operation just by the fact that you live in Casper, Wyoming. It is puzzling, and in our work at the Institute, we see this over and over again, that geography determines destiny. One of the reasons we started the Shared Decision-Making Center here at Dartmouth was to try to work on the issue of variation by patients getting involved in those decisions. And where we've done this in trials and studies, we've seen that the rates of procedures actually narrows, so that the variation or the coefficient or the amount of variation in a given surgical procedure narrows when you actually get patients involved in the decision process.
You know, we were talking earlier about the effectiveness of different spinal surgeries. One of the things that has to do with the effectiveness is how good your surgeon is. What are some of the questions you suggest that you ask a surgeon before agreeing to be operated on by him or her?
I think that's a great question, Terry. I think that today transparency is really important, and the healthcare profession is being challenged, I think, to be more transparent in providing information to the public about the outcomes of their treatment. The idea of talking to your doctor and knowing how many cases they've done of this particular diagnosis, what their results are, I think are all fair questions. I think advocating for having the decision process where you feel like you have the knowledge about the decisions you're making, that you've been provided that information in a way that you can understand it and understand the risk and benefits, is extremely important, whether it's a surgical decision or a medical decision. Today, I think we have to ask our healthcare providers, physicians, hospitals, and others to provide us with that kind of information. These are really important decisions for families to make, and they should be made in an informed choice way.
You were telling us earlier when talking about your own spinal problems that you haven't yet gotten an MRI. It was in part because you felt like you didn't even want to know, and also because MRIs are limited in what they can tell you, because they sometimes mislead you and show you something being wrong that isn't actually the cause of the symptoms. Do you get anxious about recurrences? You know, are you the kind of person who worries about back pain when you get it and worries about getting it again after it's gone away?
I don't worry about it, but I because I actually accept that it's going to happen again, and I think that the listener shouldn't be afraid either. I think that recurrences are very common. 30% of people will have recurrences within the year of their first episode. So, and again, the fear of recurrence and that something's gone wrong or you've done something wrong isn't the case. You can't prevent it. I think what you can do is try to stay in good condition so that when you get a recurrence that your body's better able to tolerate it and that you can recover faster. If you don't stay in good condition and exercise, I think when you get a recurrence, it's harder to recover. But I think, Terry, that's true with any condition. I think the more that we're in good physical condition, I think it helps our mind and I think it helps our body to recover faster. Being in good condition and moving forward probably helps me to not be so much afraid. And I think the listeners shouldn't be afraid, but they have to have the expectation that it will occur again. But more often than not, over 90% of the time, it's going to get better just as it did the first time.
Well, Dr. Weinstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, gosh, it's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you so much.
Dr. James Weinstein is chairman of the Department of Orthopedics at Dartmouth Medical School. Coming up, music from the upcoming Bob Dylan biopic. This is Fresh Air. The new Todd Haynes film about the life of Bob Dylan, I'm Not There, doesn't open until November 21st. But the two-disc soundtrack album, featuring 34 Dylan songs covered by an array of artists from Ramblin' Jack Elliott to Sonic Youth, is already released. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Things are crashing there. She's all too tight. In my neighborhood, she cried both day and night. It's a milestone, but she's down on her luck. The days make her so lonely, and it's so hard to buck now and then.
That's Sonic Youth covering the title song from Todd Haynes' new Bob Dylan biopic. The movie, as you may have heard, uses six different actors, including Cate Blanchett and Richard Gere, playing Dylan at various times in his life. In a parallel manner, the soundtrack album is loaded with Dylan as diffused through many different sensibilities. Sonic Youth, the quintessential New York noise band, uses its gnarled guitar sound and muzzy vocals to give the title song, which began this review, a lot of power. And listen to the way Jim James, lead singer of the band My Morning Jacket, offers a soaring version of Going to Acapulco.
I'm going down to Rosemary's. She never does me wrong. She puts it to me plain as day and gives it to me for a song. It's a wicked lie, but what the hell? Don't everybody got to eat? And I'm just the same as anyone else when it comes to scratching for my meat.
Jim James never phrases like Dylan, but he has a ghostly howl that's like a modern blues man singing folk music. He's unexpectedly perfect. To be sure, most cover albums throughout the course of rock history have been almost always awful. It's particularly tricky to cover Dylan well, given his distinctive voice and copious verbal content. Over the years, the best Dylan covers have come from unlikely sources. Brian Ferry's 1973 grand pop operatic version of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and Manfred Mann's Earth Band, which in the early 70s usually included at least one terrific, idiosyncratic Dylan cover on every album. A significant number of covers on I'm Not There don't work either. Take this obtuse, pedestrian interpretation of All Along the Watchtower by Eddie Vedder.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said the Joker to the confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth.
Eddie Vedder sings as though he has a trademark stamped on his vocal cords. All music copyright Pearl Jam. He doesn't give himself over to the song, the way, for example, Cat Power does on Stuck Inside of Mobile. She sings it the way Cate Blanchett portrays Dylan in the movie, with a female sensibility that reveals new possibilities in Dylan's personality and music.
How the rag man draws circles up and down the block. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know he don't talk. Treat him kindly and furnish.
flashing with tape. But deep inside his heart, I know he can't escape.
Like director Todd Haynes' movie, the I'm Not There soundtrack skips all around Dylan's history, coming to rest, finally, with the title song, a previously unreleased track recorded by Dylan and the band in 1967. The allure of the title song is irresistible, since it suggests Dylan's constantly shifting forms and images. It turns inside out Gertrude Stein's phrase, "There is no there there." Dylan is here everywhere, even when he's insisting he's not.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from Netflix and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, presenting Hostel Part 2, about a terrifying European hostel, on DVD at Netflix.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, life inside the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Defense attorney Clyde Stafford Smith says in a new book, countless innocent men have been held there for years with no meaningful review of the accusations against them, often suffering terrible abuse. We'll get a different view from Captain Pat McCarthy, chief counsel for the U.S. government in Guantanamo. Join us for the next Fresh Air.